Dear Art, I had to fax when I heard other time travelers calling in from any time past the year 2500 AD. Please let me explain. Time travel was invented in 2034. Offshoots of certain successful fusion reactor research allowed scientists at CERN to produce the world's first contained singularity engine. The basic design involves rotating singularities inside a magnetic field. By altering the speed and direction of rotation, you can travel both forward and backward in time. Welcome to the Oddity Archive with Evan and David. I am seeing waveforms. There we go.
Waveform check, waveform check. All right.
All right, we're going to attempt recording remotely.
God help us.
We may never come out of this alive. Do we need to do, for like editing purposes, do we need to do any sort of like countdown so that we're synced up?
I'll be able to kind of figure it out.
Okay.
But if we want, we can just like do 3, 2, 1, 0 real quick, and that'll give me some kind of like starting point.
Do we both say it?
Yeah.
All right.
Three, two, one. And welcome back, everyone, to Oddity Archive. This is our fifth episode here, and welcome. Per usual, I will be coming in a little bit on the unknown side of things. David, do you have a good story here this week for us?
I do. Kind of hard to do a jump in from the intro music when you have no idea what the episode is about. Excellent job. The question, actually, I want to pose to you is, if you could time travel, when would you go to?
That's a good question. I mean, I think everybody's go-to answer is always like dinosaurs. I think that'd be pretty cool. Or just like the 90s. You know, that was a good time.
That is almost where we're going tonight.
Oh, perfect. Great.
That was going to be my answer, too. Whenever somebody says, if you could time travel, where would you go to? I just ignore the question, or I break the rules of the question, if you will. And I'm always like adding where I would go also. Like if somebody's like, where would you time travel to? I'm like, well, I would want to be in Zimbabwe in that schoolyard to see what happened with the UFO.
I mean, that's almost more important than just the year. Because if you're like 1995 and then they put you in the middle of a field in New Zealand by yourself, it's a little different than if you're like wherever something's kind of popping off for that.
But I think that's the more pure answer to the question, when would you travel to? Because you just kind of have to pick an era or a time, you know, and I think late 90s, early 2000s, those are some good times in our lives.
Yeah, I feel like there was a little bit less drama back then, a little less like online toxicity. Like the internet was still super fun, kind of Wild West stuff. It seemed like a good time to come up as a kid.
Yeah, definitely. And I was reading something online, I think it may have been on Reddit, and somebody made the comment of that was the time when we still had websites. And that sounds like an odd thing to say, but back then, if you got online, you had to know where you were going. You had to type in a web address. Google was in its infancy. We had this thing called Ask Jeeves, where you would ask an online butler where to go for things. It was a whole situation.
Did you have like go-to websites back then that you still remember? I remember like going to like Flash Games were real big in high school and stuff like that. There's like a few good sites for that.
Flash Games, absolutely.
But I mean, YouTube came out when I was in high school, but it was great. You could just go there and like watch films that people had uploaded, like full movies that had just released. Like that was back when it was owned by like, it was like a private company.
It was not corporate.
You could literally upload like anything. It was interesting times as far as like sharing things online.
Yeah. And that's what the internet used to be, is it used to be just regular people making websites about their interests, and you would go to them and learn about whatever this random person's interest is.
Yeah, I mean, I remember I took an HTML class in high school, and I had like a website about how much I loved PlayStation 2. So it was kind of like this interesting time where like anyone who was like nerdy enough could like kind of throw their weird thing online. So there's just like a lot of really weird websites. They weren't always like made well, but just like kind of fun to just go poke around and see what kind of like see inside people's heads and like what they're kind of dreaming up to post online and willing to share. There's just a lot of weird, like kind of off-kilter humor stuff I remember kind of came out around then. I think that's like when the first memes started coming out, like the dancing baby, that 3D thing.
Was that the first thing to go viral?
I think that's one of the first memes, and it was like, even my dad knew what that was, and like us at school knew what it was.
Yeah,
the dancing. I probably downloaded it on Kazaa.
That's a blast from the past. Yeah, but the internet used to not be as corporate, I guess would be,
yeah,
to sum it up.
Yeah.
Now, were you a member of any message boards?
I was definitely active on the PlayStation one and going in there and posting every day, just like talking about games and stuff like that. I'm trying to think if I had any other, I mean, I had a MySpace eventually, and, you know, have like the terrible song pick that you put on there and like blow everybody's speakers with like Wonderwall. I was very Oasis focused back in those days. But I'm trying to think if I had any other like regular go-tos, but it was mostly like video game related. I was like a big video game nerd, so that was kind of my circle.
Okay.
How about you?
The one that I remember the most was a Lord of the Rings forum, because I mean, you experienced my obsession with Lord of the Rings firsthand.
Yeah, you. If I remember right, you watched all three director cuts in one sitting, which I think checks out to like, what, 12 like 9 hours?
12 hours. Oh,
well, yeah. I was way off.
I remember that. I spent 12 hours in my room, and I watched all three in a row.
Respect.
And I'm pretty sure I was the only one in our friend group that was like really into these movies, and I'm almost certain I made all of you go to the midnight showing of the last one with me.
I remember going to that last one, yeah. That was like midnight movie releases used to be like a way bigger deal too, I feel like.
I loved going to midnight movies, but
especially for stuff like that. I mean, people would like dress up and everybody was there to kind of like have a Lord of the Rings party almost like while they watched the movie. It was always a good time.
Yeah, yeah. So this conversation actually sets the tone really well for this episode. We're going to be talking about John Titor. Have you ever heard of John Titor?
It doesn't ring a bell.
Okay. So John Titor was someone who posted on one of those message boards that was aimed at time travel.
Okay.
The story actually starts off a few years before the message board postings. This story, briefly, we have a stop in 1998. So we're going back, ooh, what would that be, 27 years?
Okay.
So in 1998, there's a radio show called Coast to Coast AM. I'm going to assume you haven't heard of Coast to Coast AM.
I wasn't too big on AM radio back in the day.
Yeah, I don't think most people are. Even back then, it was kind of getting phased out. But Coast to Coast AM, it's if you're in the paranormal space, you know this radio show.
Was this like a nationally broadcasted thing, or was this like very local?
It's broadcasted nationally. It's still broadcast nationally.
Oh, okay.
They've changed hosts. The original host, Art Bell, he passed away. But it's on 7 nights a week from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. So it's on middle of the night.
Tapping a very specific kind of crowd. It seems like yeah. There, yeah.
Every night of the week. As far as I know, I don't know what the station is, but as far as I know, it is still on every morning from 1 to 5 a.m.
Is it still on AM radio, or has it moved to like an online?
I don't know. I've never actually listened to it myself.
Just curious what the vibe is.
So it started off, Art Bell, he is a legend in the paranormal world. He was the host of it. He created Coast to Coast AM, and his show started off as some sort of like political commentary show. But then as people who are interested in spooky things tend to do, that kind of took over the show.
Once he saw it was getting traction, he probably was like, all right, we found our lane.
Sorry, my dog's barking.
You're good.
Yeah, and so exactly. Once he started covering some of the paranormal stuff, saw that was getting traction, getting a lot of listens, he continued down that path, and that became the show. His show became really a paranormal podcast before podcasts were even a thought.
Okay. He found his audience once he started kind of going down that road.
Yeah, and he started the show in 1988. Very quickly learned, you know, this is my niche, I'm into this stuff, and he would have people call in about whatever topic they were covering that night. So some nights he would cover ghost stories or other odd happenings, and on this particular night, he was doing a story, or he was asking for people to call in who are time travelers.
Okay.
He threw out into the universe, if time travelers exist, then they're here with us now. So I'd like to hear from you.
Did anybody call in?
Oh, yeah. His show was extremely popular. So anytime he would ask for callers, people would call in about stuff. I don't think it was during the episode, but he got a couple faxes. And the very first fax that he got was the cold open that I read.
Okay.
Talking about successful fusion reactor research at CERN, being able to alter the speed and direction of rotation that help you travel back and forth in time. He got two faxes, actually. I don't know if there's any way to track where the faxes came from. If there was a phone number attached to these faxes, it's been lost to time.
Okay.
But he got these two faxes, and they were pretty detailed about this person time traveling. He said time travel was invented in 2034, and a few other things. He was kind of concerned about people claiming to have gone past the year 2500. He said that there were a lot of issues with that, and it seemed like anybody that went past that time didn't make it back. And that seemed to be the main concern of his when he was recording or when he was writing these faxes.
And what was that year again?
They couldn't travel past 2500.
The time travelers can't. They just can't go past that year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So he said people can't travel past 2500. That was his big concern with the folks that were calling into the radio show.
Did he give any reasons why, or was it left pretty vague?
It was left pretty vague. It was just sort of people who try to travel past that time don't come back. Or they're just unable to get past that time. And so it was this big unknown, according to this person, it was this big unknown in the time travel world, 2500, what's going on with that year.
Okay.
So most of the time, if you hear somebody tell the John Teeter story, it starts with those faxes sent to Art Bell at Coast to Coast AM. I will say, and I would love for somebody to point out why I'm wrong here, but in my research for this episode, I could not find any definitive evidence that says those faxes were tied to the John Teeter message board posts that we're going to talk about here in a minute.
Hmm.
Most of the time, they tell the story exactly like I just did, that John Teeter sent these messages to Art Bell, and then he came back 2 years later and started posting on this message board.
But you're saying there's no direct evidence to draw the faxes to the forum posts.
So we talked about the phone numbers with the faxes, and there was no phone numbers that I know of that were traceable. I don't think that he signed the faxes, John Teeter.
Oh, I see what you mean. So it's not like he was like, hey, this is how time travel works. Sincerely yours, John Teeter. So somebody took that story and maybe, well, I guess we don't know. It's either him or somebody.
Yeah. And that's you're hitting the nail on the head with the impression that I get from this story is that somebody who is a fan of Art Bell heard these faxes because Art Bell read them on his show and they said, let me take this a step further.
Mm-hmm.
And now's a good time for me to preface this whole story, the whole story of John Teeter, and say, I got to be honest here. I'm not a believer on this one.
Okay.
I just love this story because it really captures, I'm going for the word, the zeitgeist of the time. We just got a little nostalgic about the internet. I think the John Teeter story really encapsulates the time period that came from, early 2000s, when you could kind of be whatever you wanted to be online.
Yeah.
I don't think doxing people existed in the year 2000.
No, there's no like swatting and all that stuff. Yeah. That's like kind of a later thing. And I mean, there's like chat bots, but there's also like, I feel like chat rooms are way bigger. Like it was just like kind of a weird time for people just meeting online in all kinds of different contexts, forums and chat rooms and all that stuff. Like just the way to interact with people online kind of blew up.
Yeah. Before that time, people, it's hard to remember because it's such a everyday ingrained part of our lives now, but you could not send a text message to someone at that time.
Yeah.
You had to pick up the phone and talk to them voice to voice. And so this idea of being able to type something out and people all over the world seeing it was brand new.
Yeah.
So that's my admission at the top here is that I don't think John Teeter was an actual time traveler, but I love the story. There's a lot of interesting stuff that comes out of this story. And let's jump into the message board postings.
Yeah, because that was going to be my follow-up is just like, So how did it come about that the radio show was linked to these forum posts?
I think just because of the contents of the faxes.
Okay.
He talks about CERN and 2034 and some of the dates. And
enough informational overlap that you could kind of like tie one to the other.
But there's no evidence that the same person did both.
Gotcha.
Other than the, like you said, the information overlap. So the forum posts in October of 2000 on, I believe it was something to the effect of timetravelerforums.com. That's not what that's
very
not,
on the nose.
Yeah, that's not what it was, but it was something that was
to like, that effect.
Yeah, it was message boards that were created so that time travelers could communicate or people could discuss time travel as a topic. Yeah. So it was not totally out of place for him to be posting.
It was a hub built for this kind of communication.
Right. And so the chats begin October 14th, the year 2000, and they only last 5 months.
Okay.
The last thing he ever posted was on March 23rd of 2001, which posting on a message board for 5 months, and we're here talking about it 25 years later, is pretty impressive.
Yeah, for sure.
So he posts under the name Time Travel _0.
Okay. This whole story just feels so early 2000s.
Because you just know that somebody already had the name Time Travel. Because that's what you would do, is you would get whatever name you wanted, and then you would just add nonsense at the end until nobody had that version of it.
Yeah. I remember when I got my first email address, I wanted to be Fat Daddy, P-H-A-T. That was taken, so I picked my favorite letter and number, so my email is FatDaddyR22, and I'll leave out the rest just in case somebody happened to have taken over that email address since then, but...
Please email FatDaddyR22.
Yeah, you can pick whatever domain you want. Let's just see if Fat Daddies are still out there, because I'm curious.
But, just ask for replies.
That was my first email address, yeah.
Okay. My first AIM screen name, I want to say, had something to do with Legolas from Lord of the Rings.
That I feel like you're right. That I kind of remember that.
But somebody had taken that, so I'm pretty sure I put like X's on each side of the name.
A naughty Legolas.
To like stylize it. Yeah, you know, I was too young to recognize that I'm doing like triple X Legolas. But
yeah.
So timetravel_0. He starts posting in October of the year 2000.
Okay.
Going forward, I'm not going to talk about these posts in chronological order, because what ended up happening is he said he was a time traveler. And he was open to questions. And so the other people on this message board kind of peppered him with questions for 5 months. And he responded to almost all of them. But there's different answers that connect in different months and days and stuff. So if I went through this chronologically, it would just be a mess.
Yeah.
So I'm going to more cover this just in general topics of questions that he answered.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
So a lot of the questions were, when are you from? Where are you from? And he said he was from the year 2036 and that he lived in Central Florida.
I don't know why that's funny to me. I'm just like, where did time travel start? I would not pick
Central Florida
there, but maybe it gets widespread enough that anyone everywhere gets a shot at. So 2036, Central Florida.
Yeah. And here is word for word some of the things that he said about Florida in 2036. So he said, I live in Central Florida with my family, and I'm currently stationed in an army base in Tampa. A world war in 2015 killed nearly 3 billion people. The people that survived grew closer together. Life is centered on the family and then the community. I cannot imagine living even a few hundred miles away from my parents. So I'm reading over some of the posts that I have printed out in front of me.
Okay.
So he said, there was a civil war in the United States that started in 2005. And that conflict went on for 10 years and actually spread to other parts of the world. And in 2015, Russia initiated a nuclear strike that other nations reciprocated. And there ended up being some sort of nuclear fallout in 2015. As a result, 3 billion people died.
You know, if he'd predicted 10 years later, I'd be a little nervous right now.
I would be. You're right. But I distinctly remember reading about this story before 2005. I remember coming across this and I got nervous.
Yeah.
I was like, hold on a minute.
This guy's just committed enough to make me a little
this
on edge.
If this guy's right, I need to start like
building a
getting that giant bucket of food from Costco.
Yeah, right.
So yeah, 2005 and then 2015, some sort of nuclear fallout, 3 billion people die. And as a result, they end up living in a much more community-driven space.
Okay.
They grow their own food. They raise their own livestock. There's not these corporate overlords that run everything.
It's back to like almost hunter-gatherer kind of like little localized communities.
Yeah, absolutely. So he says it's hard to pin down exactly what a normal day looks for him because there's been so much turmoil in his life. He said he became a soldier at age 13. And as a teenager, I think in the army, he helped his dad haul cargo. Then he went to college when he was 31 and eventually was recruited into the time travel unit shortly after.
Okay.
And another unique thing about John Teeter is that he posted pictures of stuff. I sent you, I think, three pictures earlier today. Again, it's becoming one of my favorite aspects of this podcast is just sending you no context pictures of random things.
We'll talk about this later. And I'm like, oh, okay, well.
So one of those pictures is of what he claimed was his army patch.
Yeah.
And what were the words on there?
Tempus Edax Rerum. Rerum.
Tempus Edax Rerum. And he said that that, and I don't know Latin, of course, but evidently that translates to something like time consumes all things.
And I guess I can give like a quick vibe of the logo. It's kind of like a circle with like that text underneath it. And then there's green. It says 177th. I'm guessing that's his like time travel unit. And then there's just kind of this interesting logo in the middle that's got this kind of cyclical vibe that I imagine is just kind of tapping into that, like, you know, time traveling kind of vibe.
And we'll have that up on our Instagram post for the episode.
Yeah, definitely better to give it a look than trust my shoddy description.
And I actually got that picture from Etsy. So if you're interested, people are selling John Teeter merch.
We got to find this guy, man. I'm curious if he knows how far his legacy has carried since these forum posts back in, what was it, 2000?
So I'm not going to get too caught up in the possible suspects or who could have been behind the John Teeter legend. If that's something y'all want to hear about, I'm happy to jump down that rabbit hole. It's just, in my take on this story, it's not that important. What's important is the storytelling itself.
Yeah.
Because, like I said, no, I don't believe John Teeter was a time traveler, but I love the story of it.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't really matter. It's not like a controversy to me who wrote this.
Well, and it's not like if we're like, oh, it was like Jeffrey Roberts in Georgia, people are like, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't really bring anything to the story.
Yeah. So I do have some blurbs at the end. I think I pulled them directly from Wikipedia, so I really didn't go down the suspect's rabbit hole very far. But I do have a quick, you know, these are people that could have been behind it.
Okay.
So you may be asking yourself at this point, okay, David, this guy's claiming he was a time traveler, but he says there was a civil war in the United States in 05 and nuclear fallout in 2015. Clearly those things didn't happen.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And so people in the year 2000, 2001, they didn't know to ask him that because he was predicting the future, but they did ask him about how things are different when he time travels. And that's how he brings up the idea of world lines.
World lines. Okay. Haven't heard of that. What's that?
This is the big thing that could, if John Teeter was a time traveler, then these are necessary. And so he says anytime that you time travel, you jump to a different world line.
Okay.
So think about like the multiverse.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like a parallel universes kind of thing.
Yeah. And so every time you go, you time travel, you go to a different world line. He kind of describes it like this. He says, and this is a quote from one of his posts, somebody was asking, are you able to control where you go or is it just random? And he said, yes, it can be controlled. However, the distortion unit has operational limits. Imagine your path through time is a cone. The farther away from the center of the cone, the more differences you'll see in that world line. And then he says the C204, which is the time machine model that he drives, begins to break away at about 60 years. So sort of the limit on his time machine is 60 years.
Like it will physically break apart?
It won't physically break apart, but the world line will become so distorted that he might not even recognize where he is if he travels more than 60 years.
So the cone thing, just make sure I understand that. Basically, like, your starting point is like the smallest part of the cone. The further you kind of go from that start point, the more stuff kind of just gets more abstract from the world line you're used to.
Yeah. So think about your world line being right down the center of that cone.
Yeah.
And then as you go further into the cone, you're going through more time. There's more chances or more spaces you could end up.
Okay.
The further you go. He said that the level of confidence drops rapidly after 60 years of travel and the world line divergence increases. In other words, if I wanted to go back 2,000 years and meet Christ, there's a better than average chance I would end up on a world line where he was never born.
Hmm.
So he has to go in 60 year increments.
So he can progressively move back on a consistent world line in this theory if he's not going past 60 years each time he hits a landing point or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, so he could go 60 years at a time, but he would be going every time he travels. Yeah, he would be going incrementally, and every time he traveled, he would go to a different world line. So if you think about it, he starts off on world line one, jump 160 years ago, he's on world line two, another 60 years, he's on world line three, another world line four, and so on and so forth. So if you went 2,000 years, you'd end up on, I don't know, world line 20 or 30 or something.
Yeah, gotcha.
So yeah, you'd still end up pretty far away from your starting point. Now, I mentioned his time machine, the C204 model.
You sent me some pictures. At least one looks like a little module control system. Is that from his ship?
So those are the pictures that he posted saying, this is my time machine, or this is the distortion unit that I use for my time machine.
And one's like a photo from the look of it, and the other one is kind of like a mechanical drawing of sorts.
A schematic.
Yeah.
He says that his time machine is a C204 model, and that uses four cesium clocks.
Cesium?
Cesium clocks. I do not know enough science to know what a cesium clock is.
Or if it's real or a fabricated word. Okay.
Yeah. And he said that they had come up with the C206, which uses six cesium clocks, but they use an optical system to check the oscillation frequency. This makes the world line divergence confidence much higher. So they were getting better and better at building time machines at this point.
Okay.
Now, he had to put this time machine into a vehicle. Do you want to guess what kind of vehicle he put it into? I'll give you kind of a hint, and we'll get into what his mission was next. But he originally traveled back to 1975.
I guess as the question, was he being inconspicuous while he did so, or was he just like, what's up, Lamborghini?
Inconspicuous.
Yeah. I guess it would be like, I don't know, like, let's go with like an old Cadillac. That's kind of what I like to picture.
Not bad. He put his time machine in a 67 Chevy.
Okay. I'm here for it.
Now, there were some debates online whether this was a Camaro or a Corvette or some other Chevy. People couldn't really tell exactly what vehicle it was, but he says that it was in a 67 Chevy.
The further back he goes, I guess the 67 Chevy looks more out of place. You guys seen Jesus?
So he put it in a 67 Chevy, and then people were asking him, what are the physical sensations when you time travel?
Mm-hmm.
And he said that the gravity field generated by his time travel unit overtakes you very quickly. You feel a tug toward the unit similar to rising quickly in an elevator. And it continues to rise based on the power setting the unit is working under. At 100% power, the constant pull of gravity can be as high as 2 G's or more, depending on how close you are to the unit. There are no serious side effects, but I try to avoid eating before a flight. So I think part of his enduring legacy is how detailed he got in these responses.
I feel like he's got to have some kind of science background. It was just like having a great time, just getting in full character, and he's got enough knowledge to like really flesh out the world a bit.
He knows enough to give informed answers to these things.
Yeah, and make it believable.
Yeah. He said, again, the C204 unit is accurate from 50 to 60 years a jump and travels about 10 years an hour at 100% power.
Okay.
So this is not an instantaneous jump from where you are to where you want to be. It takes time to travel through time.
So 60 years, that's like a 6-hour flight, for lack of a better...
Yeah. So, you know, if you wanted to go back to the year zero and meet Christ, you'd be in there for quite a while.
Yeah, you'd be sitting in your Camaro for a hot minute.
Yeah. So he says, when you're actually doing the time traveling, no bright flash of light is seen. Outside, the vehicle appears to accelerate as the light is bent around it. We have to wear sunglasses or close our eyes as this happens due to a short burst of ultraviolet radiation. Personally, I think it looks like you're driving under a rainbow. After that, it appears to fade to black and remains totally black until the unit is turned off. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. This is prime time for Mario Kart 64.
That's the first place. I was like, sounds a lot like Rainbow Road. Yeah.
Yeah. Rainbow Road. I just want that to be an inspiration for that sentence. He says, you do hear a slight hum as the unit operates, and when the power changes or the unit turns off, there's a great deal of electrical crackling noise from the static electricity.
Okay.
So if you ever wanted to know what it's like to time travel.
Yeah, as I say, he paints a good picture. Like half the reason this stuff probably caught on is you can kind of see it in your head.
Yeah. And so let's get to his mission.
Yeah.
Why is he time traveling at all?
That's a good point. Yeah.
So as I referenced, he originally had to go back to 1975. What do you think he needed in 1975? This is an impossible question.
I was like, if you're trying to expose my lack of history knowledge, you're about to succeed. I was like, to save JFK. 1975, he wanted to get a hair product that was discontinued.
I like that answer. Yeah, when they had like something that had way too many chemicals in it.
Yeah, he had some waves going, and he just like nothing's quite done as well as when he was younger and like really in his prime.
2036 Florida, really lacking on hair care.
Yeah, right. His community hasn't been able to find the local ingredients to rebuild his former perm care.
Yeah. So, close. He was going back to 1975. His mission was to obtain an IBM 5110.
That was my second guess.
Yeah, I figured that was going to be your second guess.
That's a computer, right?
Yeah. So the IBM 5100, it was one of the first ever portable computers mass produced.
So like the chunky laptops, or I guess back then even it'd be even bigger than that, more like a suitcase.
I'm thinking, I had the exact same thought. I was like, they were making laptops in 75. I think what this means is it's one of the first ever like tower computers that you could pick up and move.
Yeah.
It didn't like take up a whole room.
There was no screen. Probably it's just getting the computer from A to B.
Yeah. So it was one of the first ever portable computers mass produced.
Okay.
He claimed that he was actually related to one of the engineers that worked on the 5100. And so he went back to Rochester, Minnesota in 1975, and he obtained a 5100 to then take back to 2036.
So I guess the question is, why? I mean, unless the community he's living in, did they have like a need for a computer? Did he ever elaborate on like why that?
Yes. So this is, to me, the most interesting aspect of the John Teeter story is why he went back and why he needed it. So he went back to get the 5100. He got a 5100. He said that he needed it because in 2036, they needed a computer that could debug legacy computer programs, because they were dealing with something called the year 38 problem.
Okay. Is that like a Y2K kind of deal?
So yeah, you're actually exactly right. It is another Y2K problem. And it's all based on something, I don't have the technological knowledge, a thing called Unix.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you know what Unix is? Can you enlighten me?
I mean, I'm not like a coder by any means. I feel like when I've heard Unix discussed, it's basically just like what the Mac OS is kind of built on, which like might be like a Linuxy kind of thing.
Okay.
But I couldn't deep dive. Yeah, I think Mac OS is somehow kind of based around it.
Okay, so that makes sense. So it's a big issue because in the research that I did, this is all I know about Unix, is it's an operating system that uses a 32-bit time format. And so it measures time in seconds in binary. And so once it started counting. That 32-bit system, it's going to be full at 3:14 and 7 seconds on January 19th of 2038.
3:14
and 7 seconds.
AM or PM? Does that matter? 7 seconds.
I assume AM.
Yeah, let's go with AM.
Yeah, January 19th of 2038. So this is a very real problem.
Like this exists in...
This exists in the real world.
I guess his world was the same as ours. Well,
kind of. Kind of, yeah.
You know what I mean. Yeah.
So, yeah, that problem is a very real problem. People are working on trying to figure it out. It's the same type of thing as Y2K. After that time, everything is going to roll over so that the computers don't know what year or time or day or anything. Like, everything is going to get messed up from it.
Yeah.
So we've talked about he had to have some science knowledge to know about some basic concepts of time travel or possibilities.
Yeah.
He also had to have some sort of technological knowledge to know that this problem was going to exist in the year 2000.
Yeah. Based on who I would expect to gravitate towards the timetravelers.org forum or whatever he said it was called, I could see a lot of like computer science kind of people gravitating towards that. Like, it seems like that would kind of be their world.
Yeah.
I've never heard of that, though, that problem existing.
Yeah. And so he said that they needed the IBM 5100 essentially to be able to translate computer programs from Unix to other operating systems so that they could try and solve this problem by shifting everything away from this operating system or whatever Unix is that's going to get messed up in 2038.
I will say it's interesting to me, though, that you said these posts started in 2000. So Y2K was probably pretty fresh.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is almost like the next computer problem of how computers handle this rollover.
This was only 10 months after the Y2K problem.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're right. It is still fresh in people's minds. Now, John Teeter, in talking about the 5100, he said that he needs it because it has an inbuilt ability to translate computer languages. So he posted these in the year 2000-2001.
Mm-hmm.
3 years after his last post in 2004, Bob Dubuque, D-U-B-K-E. I'm going to say Dubuque.
Dubka.
Dubka. So 3 years after John Teeter made his last post, mm-hmm. Bob Dubka, who was actually the second engineer of the IBM 5100, confirmed that the 5100 did have this ability. And prior to this, nobody knew that the 5100 was capable of this other than the insiders that worked on the computer system itself.
Was just very forward thinking of very brainy. People were like, oh, this is a problem. Like, let's go ahead and solve this. And like, it's funny to me that they would think that far ahead on like this being an issue.
The engineers that worked on the 5100, the ability wasn't in relation to the 2038 problem. That is its own thing.
Okay.
The 5100 had the ability to emulate different operating systems. And that's kind of the root of what John Teeter was saying. We need the 5100 so that we can translate from one operating system to the next. But at the time he was posting, it was not public knowledge.
It just sounds so advanced for back then too, to be able to.
Yeah.
I don't think we can we do that now? Now with like Windows and Mac.
Yeah. So now it would be the same thing as like you're on a Mac.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're on a Mac right now running a Windows program.
Yeah. Partitioning a drive of or something like along those lines where you can read another OS's code by running it within like a shell of another thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so the 5100 was capable of doing that with programming languages in 1975. It was able to translate from language to language.
Okay.
But the IBM programmers that made the 5100, as far as I can tell, they were doing this sort of as a proof of concept because they never made it public. Nobody ever knew that the 5100 was capable of this until John Teeter mm-hmm. released it on timetraveler.com.
And I guess I don't even know what the general public would do with that knowledge, but it's still interesting. Like, you think of emulation as being like kind of a recent thing with like you know, playing old video games on like modern computers and things like that. Like, you wouldn't think about it being around even in the 70s.
Absolutely. So, again, this is the most interesting part of this story to me, because he had to have had some sort of insider knowledge, because IBM in the 70s, 80s, 90s was a very powerful company.
Yeah, they were running it, man. They were like the company.
And if they wanted to keep something secret, that thing was staying secret.
Yeah.
And so for him to have this knowledge and release it on timetravelermessageboards.com, is pretty interesting to me, because even after he posted that, it took three more years for somebody to come out and be like, well, hold on, actually, he's right. Like, it did have this ability.
Well, and what was Bob Dubka? Was he like part of IBM?
Bob Dubka. He was the number two engineer in charge of building the 5100.
Oh, so he clearly had some intimate knowledge then on that device or computer, or whatever you want to call it. So was Bob Dubka? Was he John Teeter?
John Teeter. He is not one of the suspects.
He's my number one suspect.
They didn't do anything illegal, but it's just fun to call them suspects.
Yeah.
And so that really is the story of John Teeter, is that he came in October of 2000. He posted very detailed knowledge of time travel, where he was from. He was very good at storytelling. And then 5 months later, March of 2001, he left, and nobody has ever heard from him ever again. He led up to that by saying, there's going to be a window coming up for my departure, and I'll be leaving you all. So he didn't just disappear. He prefaced, I am going to be leaving soon. I'm going back to 2036.
I was going to say, maybe he went to past year 2500, and he just was like, you know what?
That's true. He's a being of light now.
Yeah. It's like, I got to know what happens past 2500. So it's interesting. I mean, like, you sent me that patch and you're like, that's on Etsy. You can like buy that today. So clearly this has like at least some kind of cult following. But I mean, I've never heard the story, a word of it. So how did you come across this initially? Is there
can you hear my dog like chomping on this bone?
Yeah.
Hey, Charlotte. Stop. Go somewhere. Stop it. Hold on.
You're good.
Okay. Bone chewing is over.
So there's like this patch on Etsy. Clearly there's still some kind of following that finds the story interesting. What's kind of the legacy that's still going for this guy or his story?
I'm sure there are some people that look at this story as being a time traveler and they take every word that he says truthfully. I think for the vast majority of people, this is filed under sort of like an internet urban legend.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's what it is for most people. I know for me, like I said earlier, I can remember hearing about this story. It had to have been before 2005, because that's when he said the U.S. Civil War starts. And so, like, I have memories from like 03, 04, probably being like, hold on, if this guy's right, then I need to like buy some ammo or something.
Gotta hunker down, yeah. And you're probably like 13 at the time, like, Dad,
we gotta be ready.
Wake up. So, yeah.
So I can remember it from then. And I know it's not something I think about very often, but just, you know, from time to time, every few years since then, I would sort of, it would pop into my head for one reason or another, and I would sort of check in on John Teeter's like predictions coming true. And then after 2015, when he said there was nuclear winter, basically, after that didn't happen, we're in the clear. I can return those buckets to Costco. They got a great return policy.
Yeah, I like to picture you in just like a cold sweat for most of 2015. Like, oh God, Teeter, why?
Teeter,
no.
So, and so it's just an internet legend that I've always enjoyed hearing about, because I guess part of it is probably that it just takes me back to a simpler time in my life.
Yeah. It just channels that time perfectly. There was just weird little stuff like that would pop up that internet pockets would really gravitate towards. And it felt like it was still like within your niche. I mean, I probably didn't hear about it because I just wasn't in that circle. But like, you know, if it had happened on the PlayStation forum, I would have been like, oh my God, did you guys hear? You haven't heard about that? But I feel like people had their social circles online and it was more positive and fun than it is now, where people come in and be like, that's not like real. That's like, this is all made up, whatever.
Yeah.
Like people were just happy to like kind of run with stuff back then because
it was more fun.
Yeah.
The internet used to be more fun.
Yeah, it was great.
I think that's it. That is an accurate statement.
Yeah.
So I said I would cover this. Again, I think the story is the heart of this, but suspects.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's get into who is John Titor?
Who could John Titor be? So this, I'm full transparency here. I copy and pasted the suspects part of Wikipedia yeah. onto a sheet of paper.
That's right. That's how I graduated college. Just rewriting.
So I did not do a lot of research. If you want, like I said, if y'all want to hear more about the possible suspects in the John Titor case, I'm happy to research this more.
Well, so before you get into the suspect list, I'm curious, has anyone come out and outright tried to claim ownership of being him, or is it just people have tried to kind of like sleuth it out?
Okay, let me read this and then we'll
get it,
because I think okay. this might answer some of your questions.
Yeah.
So again, these are just the two paragraphs from Wikipedia. I'm not presenting anything new here. So in 2009, a report by John Houston of the Hoax Hunter website pointed to Larry Haber, a Florida entertainment lawyer, as the CEO of... Wait, what? Hold on. I found a typo in Wikipedia. All right. So scrap that. I'm just going to summarize here.
Yeah.
So here's a summary of what's on Wikipedia. A guy named John Houston, he runs a website called Hoax Hunter. And I guess he did some sort of sleuthing. And he concluded that a man named Larry Haber, who is a Florida entertainment lawyer, was John Titor. So Larry Haber of Florida... And his brother, Richard, his brother, Richard, being a computer scientist.
Okay.
They are in some way involved with having created the John Titor Foundation. The John Titor Foundation is a real foundation.
Yeah.
And John Titor is a trademark that's registered with the United States Patent and Trademark Office.
Okay.
The Titor trademark currently is classified as abandoned. I don't know what that means. I'm not in trademarking at all.
I think it means you're allowed to use it without... paying rights or...
So maybe that's why Etsy got a hold of this.
Yeah, so now you can just freely print badges and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I don't see an entertainment lawyer having that deep knowledge of a 1975 computer, but then you're like, oh, his brother was kind of in that field, so I can
see
that.
Yeah, so this theory is that it was kind of Larry Haber, the entertainment lawyer, and his brother Richard working in conjunction to create the John Titor persona.
Which actually, I kind of see... Well, I guess if he's the lawyer, he's more on the like legal side, but... He's in the entertainment industry. His brother has the computer knowledge to kind of like fill in the gaps there.
Yeah. And so that's one suspect, or two suspects, really. The other possibility that's thrown around a lot is an artist named Joseph Matheny. He created an alternate reality game, Ong's Hat, that people claim is similar in some sort of way to the John Titor story. Again, I didn't dig into this. I don't know what the connection is there. But Joseph Matheny, I believe, claims himself to be John Titor.
Okay.
He said that John Titor is a story that was created as a literary experiment by people who were observing what I was doing with Ong's Hat, and these people wanted to do something like that. I was a consultant on the project, but it wasn't my project. So Joseph Matheny was saying a group of people came to him and were saying, we like your work. We'd like you to consult on us creating this persona and this story of John Titor. And then they did it.
Gotcha.
Again, I'm not all that concerned with who John Titor was.
Yeah.
I just love the story. I think it's entertaining. It takes me to a good time in my life.
I mean, it just feels so like plucked out of early 2000. I can see why you would pick it, especially if it's stuck in your head as 2015 approached or whatever. But yeah, just like straight out of 2000's internet for sure. So I know we normally end these with some sort of like you needing closure and us kind of hypothesizing. But this seems one where it's kind of just like a fun nod to our formative years and kind of the crazy world the internet was back in the year 2000 and around there.
Yeah, I'm not looking to close any doors or anything on this one. I'll just say, John Teeter, if you're out there, get in touch.
Yeah.
And for all of our listeners, please get in touch with us. If there's any stories you'd like to hear, if there's anything we've already covered that you'd like to hear more about, if you have a story of your own, something that you feel like would be good to share on the podcast, we're open to that too. You can reach us at oddityarchivepodcast@gmail.com, and our Instagram account is oddityarchivepodcast. We'll have a post for every episode, certainly, and maybe random posts in between those posts. And so reach out to us if there's anything that you feel like we need to cover.
And Bob Dubka, if you're out there, we would really love to hear from you.
Bob Dubka?
Dubka.
Calling Dubka. Please, Bob Dubka, contact us and just let us know how to say your name correctly.
And Bob Dubka, you can reach us at FatDaddyR22 at the domain of your choice.
At the domain of your choice.
All right, guys. Till the next one.
All right.
We'll see you.
See ya.
I am David Stuhlgrave, creator and host. The show is edited by my co-host, Evan Miller. All original music created by Sean Bullock. You can follow him at Sean Bullock Video on Instagram. All original artwork done by Tanis. Follow her at Tanis Tattoos on Instagram as well. Thank you for listening.